The Iron Game Chalk Talk podcast is brought to you by the following sponsors: EliteForum.com and IgnitionAPG.com. And now, the Iron Game Chalk Talk podcast. Welcome to Iron Game Chalk Talk with your host, Ron McKeefery.
Every time our athletes walk into this weight room, they're going to be pushed to the max.
Let's go! Let's go! Everything you got!
On this podcast, hear Coach McKeefery's straight talk about training, featuring the top strength and conditioning professionals from around the world. And now, here's your host, Ron McKeefery.
To Iron Game Chalk Talk, I'm your host, Ron McKeefery, and this is episode number 50. Iron Game Chalk Talk is a weekly podcast where we bring you experts in the field of strength and conditioning to talk shop. If you're not already done so, make sure you join our mailing list at ronmckeefery.com, as well as subscribe to us on iTunes and YouTube. That way you get updates each week of the latest episodes. This week, excited to have Kevin Neild with us. Kevin is the strength coach, or the president of Endeavor Sports Performance. He's a strength and conditioning coach and manual therapist for the Philadelphia Flyers junior team, and he's the assistant strength coach for USA Women's Hockey. I got to know Kevin a little bit by watching a DVD, Optimizing Movement. I'll make sure to link to that below, but it was a fantastic product, and he really is doing some really creative stuff, and wanted to have him on the show. We talk a little bit about his assessment process, these four pervasive movement considerations that he has, and then just basically how he integrates movement training into his strength and conditioning programs. I know you're really going to enjoy this episode, but before we get going, I want to recognize our sponsors, EliteForum.com and IgnitionAPG.com. Both fantastic resources for any strength and conditioning coach, and I would encourage you to reach out to them and just let them know how much you appreciate them being a part of the show. Elite Form is a sports science company based out in Nebraska, doing some awesome work, really creative things. Was one of those products that when I was walking through the exhibit hall at the CSCCA National Conference or the NSCA National Conferences, it was one of those products that I thought automatically was a game changer. And so I'd encourage you to check out their paperless system. This is something that we're using with our athletes that are not on campus. Times like these where they're home for summer break or, on a spring break or something along those lines. Their PowerTracker Lite is a device at the rack where it's basically a Tindo unit at the rack with some video feedback using a tablet. And then their Strength Planner Lite is a basically an online program design software program where you can put together your programs and saves tons of time without having to do all those Excel spreadsheets. So for a free trial of the Strength Planner Lite, email IGCT at EliteForm.com and Skip and those guys will hook you up with a free 30-day trial for being a listener of Iron Game Chalk Talk. And I'd highly encourage you. I mean, a strength coach is anytime we can get time back in our day is well worth any amount of money for a program. So I'd encourage you to check that out. Lastly, if you enjoy these podcasts, you'll definitely enjoy strength-ondemand.com. Strength On Demand is a online archive of strength and conditioning presentations that a buddy of mine, Rob Taylor, and myself put together. It's it's a product that we were looking for just to continually to learn and have a depository of different presentations from great strength coaches from around the world. And if you like these episodes, I know that you'll truly enjoy strength-ondemand.com. All right, this week got Kevin. Make sure you grab a notepad and a pen. He goes over a ton of stuff. He's a very, very smart guy, and I learned a lot from him. I know you will too. So sit back and enjoy. All right, guys, very excited to have Kevin Neild with us. Kevin, I first started following when I was with the Cincinnati Bengals, and the head strength coach, Chip Morton, turned me on to him. And so between his blog and some of his products and things he's got out there, I've been following him ever since, and he's a wealth of knowledge, way too smart for me, so you're going to have to dumb it down for me a little bit And so that's exactly why I wanted to get you on, so I can ask you some questions and get you going. But was able to watch his Optimal Movement DVD, which if you haven't watched, I'd definitely get out there and get. We'll talk a little bit about that, but was very eye-opening and a great product. And so I appreciate you coming on the show, man.
Sure. Hey, thanks for having me. It's my pleasure.
Kev, you know, for the guys that don't know you, you go a little bit into your journey. You know, how did you get into strength and conditioning? You know, who are some of the mentors you had along the way, and where are you currently at?
Sure. So I think the journey for me started as an athlete. I played ice hockey my whole life, and probably around age 14 or so, I had one of those pivotal experiences that I think a lot of people in our field have, where, you know, I coaches were telling me that, like, I saw the game really well, I had really good skill sets, but I was just too slow to really compete at higher levels. And, you know, I'm far from the most athletically gifted person out there. And, you know, at the time I came across a coach that was the first one to point out how slow I was and, you know, how underdeveloped physically I was, but at the same time ran at the time what I thought was like a pretty good off-ice training program. And through a solid year of just very dedicated training, I was able to put myself in a position to be fast enough and well-conditioned and strong enough to compete with kids that, you know, a year prior I wouldn't have been. And, you know, it took a lot of dedication, took a lot of work, it took a lot of sacrifice, but, you know, in the end there was the payoff that I think it was that experience that I told myself then, like, this is what I want to do. I want to help other people really realize their full potential, because up to that point, you know, I don't think if people don't come in contact with something like that, they don't really know what they're capable of.
Sure.
From a athletic standpoint, from a psychological standpoint, just needing to dig deep and, you know, get into really uncomfortable areas of your own personal development. So that's kind of where the journey started. And, you know, I went to the University of Delaware as an undergrad, and my senior year there, for my major and for my minor, which was strength and conditioning, they didn't have that as a major at the time. I had to do an internship for both of them. And it was interesting. I interned at the University of Delaware with their strength and conditioning, their head strength and conditioning coach, and worked with football and basketball and volleyball and field hockey with them. And then also interned at a private high school where the guy that ran the strength and conditioning was a athletic trainer that also handled strength and conditioning. And it was neat because as a senior in college, you know, he basically said, like, look, you have full reign, you know, write the programs, you can coach the guys through it. Like, you know, I'm going to supervise everything you do. But I had a lot more freedom than I think a lot of people are given at that age. And
sure.
The neat thing is, and I'm almost kind of embarrassed to admit this, but senior year of college rolls around and this is my last semester. And up to that point, I had never heard of Mike Boyle. You know, I had never heard of a lot of the guys that now I think are household names. And the University of Delaware strength coach had, I think it was functional strength coach one, Mike's 10 DVD set.
Yeah.
And he let me borrow that, and I watched it with the guy that I was doing my other internship with. And I just remember that was such an eye-opening product or, you know, lecture series. But the thing that really got me is I remember the last slide of that presentation, or one of the last slides, he had a recommended resources list. And, you know, I just remember thinking then, it's like, well, I'm no genius, but I know that this guy's smarter than I am, and he's telling me to read all of these things. So I literally went home that night, and I bought, you know, I hopped on Amazon, I bought all of those books, and I spent that summer reading all of those resources. And, you know, that was a big pivotal moment for me, because it exposed me to, like, the Thomas Myers Anatomy Trains concept, which, you know, I went through undergrad anatomy like I imagine most people did, and it wasn't that. You know, it was almost right. Like I had to reteach myself anatomy from scratch. And, you know, Shirley Sarman's on that list. I think Stu McGill's low back disorders was on that list. So kind of got me started down that path. And I ended up going to grad school at UMass Amherst and reached out to Chris Boyko, who was the he worked with several teams there, one of which was men's ice hockey, which is what I the population I wanted to work with. And he was fortunate enough to give me an opportunity to help out there my first year and put me in touch with Eric Cressy, who I interned with between my first and second year. And everything kind of came full circle for me. I ended up graduating from UMass Amherst, and a guy that I had played hockey with in the same organization where I said that I had that coach that had a decent training program, was just starting to form a business of running his own private facility, training ice hockey players primarily. So he really wanted to focus on the business side of things, and through a mutual friend that also played in that organization, we kind of got back in touch. And, you know, he said, when you graduate, would you be interested in doing this? And, you know, I was like, of course. Like, get to move back and jump right into running my own programs and working with ice hockey players primarily. And, you know, obviously, private facility, we train athletes in all sports, but hockey's kind of our bread and butter, and just stepped right into that right out of grad school, which is nice.
Oh, fantastic. Mike has been such a great resource for a lot of strength coaches, and we had him on the show, and then obviously Eric Cressy as well. So that's some great mentors you had there for sure.
Yeah, and honestly, like, it's almost just the tip of the iceberg. Like, I'm permanently indebted to Chris Boyko. A really interesting experience that I had while interning with Cressy is we went to what I think was originally called the Northeastern Distinguished Lecturer Series, which was the Art Horn's first seminar, I think. And a guy named Mike Potenza spoke at that. And afterwards, you know, Eric knew Mike, and he, like, after we all kind of parted ways, Eric was like, you know, I think Mike would be open to talking to you if you're interested. And, you know, at the time, it's like, I'm an unemployed grad student interning at Cressy, so I'm like, yeah, you know, like, get an opportunity to
right. An
NHL strength coach. Like, I'd love to. And Mike called me when I was at Eric's, and one of the interesting things about that experience is, you know, here I am, again, grad student, minimal experience, like, volunteering at somebody else's facility. Mike had been in the NHL for several years at that point, and I think we talked for an hour, and the entire time was him asking me questions, which was humbling.
Yeah.
To have a guy of that caliber just, like, just fire questions at you. It just kind of, that was the, one of many experiences, I think, that I've had with people that I consider the best in the business, that they're just constantly looking for more information, and they're the most humble and down-to-earth people out there. And, you know, a couple years later, I was fortunate, Mike invited me out to San Jose to help out with one of their development camps. And, you know, it was, like, the same type of experiences where, you know, at the end of the day, like, Mike didn't ask us to wipe down the equipment. We would just look over, and Mike would be in the middle of wiping down all the equipment. It's like, all right, like, I'm not going to stand here and let the head coach wipe down all the equipment by himself. You know,
no, it's that's just, right.
So many people that have taught lessons like that, like, lead by example, never stop learning. You know, be very humble along the way.
Sure. Well, that's what, you know, one of the things I've always said on the show is that, you know, the longer you're in this business and the more you go, you figure out that you're just now starting after, you know, like me, after 18 years, I'm just now starting to ask the right questions, you know, now I've gotten past the point where I think I know all the answers. Now I'm really getting into, you know, what are the things that I truly need to know and how to, you know, and you can learn that from everybody, you know, anybody and everybody. And so that's an important lesson. I'm glad you brought that up. You know, at Endeavor there, you know, I've always been really impressed, or at least, you know, since I followed you, on your assessment process. You know, when a hockey team comes in or a new player comes in, what does that process look like for you, and kind of how do you get them to the weight room?
Sure. So the assessment process for me really started by learning the FMS, and then just knowing with ice hockey players, like, okay, looking at hip range of motion and that sort of thing, it's just, to me, it was important information to have. So even if it wasn't directly something that influenced our programs then, I wanted to have some data so that if I have a guy, which, you know, this will be my sixth summer starting up now, and we're starting to see this, where I can look back at somebody when they were a 17-year-old kid, and I can see what their hip range of motion was, and then I can see what it was when they left to go play juniors, and now I can see what it is after their sophomore year playing Division I hockey. So it all started with the FMS for me, and then my journey kind of introduced me to the Postural Restoration Institute and started to integrate some of their concepts. But basically, when a new kid comes in, we go through a body fat analysis. We go through the functional movement screen. We go through many of the tests that I learned at the Postural Restoration Institute courses. You know, an extension drop test, which is a modified Thomas test for people that are more familiar with that. An adduction drop, which is basically just a modified Obers test. I'll do a passive abduction test to get an idea of what that feels like on both sides. We're looking at different breathing patterns just to get an idea of does this person have the ability to expand the rib cage upon inhalation on both sides, or is there a limitation on one, or do they notice something that feels different on one side compared to the other? And then other than that, we've mixed in, like, I learned an ankle mobility assessment from Brett Jones at the FMS level 2 course that isn't part of the FMS, but we've done that a lot. We'll do a seated T-spine rotation test just to get an idea of how people are moving through the thoracic spine, and then a few other, you know, like we'll goniometer hip internal and external rotation in a seated position, and then we'll do a quadruped rock test, which, you know, just hands and knees and try to keep a neutral spine and see how far they can go into hip flexion before they start to tuck. So
Right. That's
kind of the general idea of it, and I think the goal for that, you know, isn't to say like, oh, this guy's so banged up, you can't do X, Y, and Z, but it's to, one, get data to track them over time to see, are they adapting favorably or not across the years. And, you know, we assess somebody when they leave us, and then we assess them when they get back to us, when they come back from college or whatever the case is. And we have some pretty good information to say, like, hey, maybe what you were doing in season wasn't enough for this quality. You know,
right.
Never to undermine what the strength and conditioning coach is doing in that setting, but to just give this kid a little bit more personal feedback on some things that they can integrate while they're there. But I think the big thing for us is, you know, it drives our corrective approach from a program design standpoint to say, like, all right, before you train and after you train, we just want you to do these two or three things. You know, hammer out a couple sets, do it for a couple weeks, we'll reassess, we'll see if it's getting better.
Right.
It also helps with exercise selection, and I think this is one of the big concepts that people misunderstand about the FMS. It allows you to pre-qualify if somebody has the capacity to perform certain movements appropriately. And if they don't, honestly, it doesn't mean that you can't do them. Like, if somebody's supposed to have, you know, 4 inches of ankle mobility or ankle dorsiflexion on that test and they have 2, it doesn't mean you can't front squat them. It just means that you should be aware that they're probably going to hit a point in the range of motion where they run out of ankle mobility, and
yeah.
What happens when that at that point? And if you know going in that that's going to happen, then, you know, you can choose not to do that exercise and choose one that may suit their current capacity a little bit better while you're working on improving ankle mobility. Or you can say, depending on the situation, like, hey, I have 40 guys coming in at once. I can't give them 30 different exercises to do because it would be chaos.
Right.
I won't do it anyway, but maybe modify that individual's range of motion, or maybe not, and you just acknowledge that that's the cost of doing business for that individual, and, you know, you just kind of hedge your bets, like,
yeah.
You know, the risk of injury or poor movement go up, yeah, like, are you comfortable with that? Like, I think having that information going in just allows you to make more informed decisions. And
I totally agree. I totally agree. When you're doing these assessments in a team setting, you know,
sure.
have you found any tricks of the trade to make that an easier process? I mean, I think about a college setting where I've got, you know, 50 football players coming in 2 different groups, you know, to sit down and really go through a, you know, goniometer test and a FMS screening and a, you know, how do you cycle teams through to effectively make that a quick process?
Yeah, so I'm very fortunate in our setting that we do almost entirely small group training. And, you know, in the interest of full disclosure, sometimes we'll get a team that'll come in and we'll have 20 guys. And because of the budget of their booster club or whatever the situation is, they might say, like, you know, we're going to come in once a week for 4 weeks. And it's like, all right, you know, like,
right.
We can take the time to screen out 20 kids and then give them individualized warm-ups and write individualized programs. It's like, no, it's by the time that you get done teaching them the basics, they're already gone. You
yeah.
know, it's like by the time they finally learn how to move to perform exercises with a minimum competency, they're done. So I don't have that problem a lot, but I did start this year. There's a new U20 hockey team in our area that I was the strength and conditioning coach for, and that was a lot of fun for me because it was the situation that you're describing. I mean, basically 25 kids came into training camp, and
right.
You need to figure out, like, one, most of these kids have never been assessed. Half of these kids have never lifted before. None of these kids, like, you know, I don't know how much you've dug into the Postural Restoration Institute information, but it can get a little cerebral. You know, if you're
right.
not used to doing anything with focused breathing, that can be a big leap for people. So basically what we did, Ron, is myself and then two of the guys that I work with, we just set up an assembly line, and people came in and I would knock out body fats. And when they finished doing body fat with me, they would go do some of the FMS mobility tests. So the active straight leg raise, the ankle mobility, the shoulder mobility, and a quadruped rock test with my two other guys. And then by the time everybody finished with that, I was already done doing body fats on everybody. And we cycled back and started throwing guys on the table. And with, you know, I've probably gone through that process now on a few hundred people. So
right.
When I go through it with somebody on the table, it only takes 3 or 4 minutes to get through somebody. So
sure.
You know, a little bit of waiting around, but we divided them up into two groups and just knocked it out. And really wasn't that prohibiting with that number of people. But, you know, I think when I was at the San Jose Sharks and I helped out Mike at that prospect camp, we FMS everybody, and it was a similar idea. I think we set up like 5 or 7 stations and then just cycled guys through. And when they finished one, you know, maybe it freed up a coach to start running the next
right.
station for everybody.
Right.
So,
well, most people throw it into their, you know, their physical process when they're getting their physicals, and it's part of that. You know, they'll go through with the doctors and they'll come in, they'll get their FMS, and then they walk out. But that's good, man. What, you know, give us a couple takeaways here, you know, a couple ideas with the focus breathing, because that is new to me. You know, in a team setting, a college setting, you know, what are some things that maybe we should look for, and then what are some ways to improve our breathing techniques?
Sure. So you can look at breathing in a few different ways, and I think one of the big ones that we use it for is just very simply as a mechanism or as a method to help stimulate a parasympathetic shift in somebody. So regardless of the breathing strategy that you use, if you calm yourself down and focus on inhaling and focus on exhaling and pause after you exhale and just make that like a slow rhythmic process where your mind's focused on that, it's going to help calm down your body. So when I had, you know, this group of 25 U20 hockey players, if you can imagine that, as in a lot of high school and college settings, that, you know, emphasizing breathing technique might get you laughed at, and, you know,
right.
the kids be like, I'm not doing this, this is stupid. But what I pitched to those guys is during training camp, at the end of the training sessions, we just said, like guys, we're going to be doing a lot of things that rely on this breathing pattern, so all I want you guys to do is lay down on the ground, throw your feet up on the wall. Like, all we're going to do is spend 2 minutes. I just want you guys to focus on breathing in through your nose, out through your mouth, pause for a few seconds after you exhale, and just do that for 2 minutes. And the reason we're doing this is because it's going to help shift your body out of game mode into a more restful state so you can start the recovery process faster.
Mm.
And the thing that I said after that that I think really resonated with a lot of our guys is hockey, like I imagine a lot of team sports, a lot of those kids are familiar with playing late night games, and you know, they might get off the ice at 10, they might get home, and by the time they're showered and everything at 11, and then they lay in bed and their mind's racing, their body's racing until 1 o'clock in the morning. And that's 2 hours where, you know, maybe they allotted 11 to 7 to sleep, but they're really not even going to sleep until 1, and then their quality of their sleep is garbage after that point.
Yeah.
Anyway. So I just told the guys, just like, look, like, this is a strategy that you can use to help you shut down before you go to bed. It'll help you fall asleep faster. And unprompted, I had probably a dozen or a half dozen kids come up to me like 2 days later and say, like I tried it, it worked.
Yeah.
And that, you know, like, that's when they start talking to each other in the locker room.
Yeah.
And I didn't have any trouble. Like, all of our kids had individualized correctives all season long. They changed frequently. And a lot of them were very heavily breathing based, and we had zero problems with it all season long. You know, like, a couple
right.
knuckleheads that, you know, depending on the day, didn't get a good night's sleep and aren't into it on any given day. But as a whole, like, almost 100% compliance, which in that setting couldn't, you know, I would have been happy with a lot less compliance
right.
that way.
No, that's great.
That's one of the things, is you can look at it as a just a way to kind of shut down the nervous system and drive a parasympathetic shift.
No, that's fantastic. So, you know, I'm assuming now, you know, from a programming standpoint, then, you know, your athletes, they come in, they're assessed, you come up with a program, they come in and they get their correctives on their own, and then what? They're going right into, you know, agility movement training, or are they going into strength training? How does your system work?
Yeah, so it really depends on, like, the training goal of any given phase for any given athlete, but just as, like, a general bird's eye view, kids will come in, they'll get their program, they'll foam roll. they'll do their corrective stuff. They'll do some sort of like combined mobility dynamic warm-up movement. They'll go through a locomotion series if they're either A, younger and need to practice on things like butt kickers and skipping and shuffling body position and that sort of thing. Or if they're going to sprint or jump that day, they'll go through locomotion stuff. And then if all of these things are in any given training day, it would be speed work, power work, strength work with core and activation stuff mixed in, and then the quote-unquote conditioning stuff at the end. But again, like there are days that somebody might come in and they might do their correctives and their mobility work and then jump into a like 60-minute full-body aerobic circuit, you know, with 10 different movements in it. There are other days where people come in and they will sprint, they'll do Olympic lifts, they'll you know, do max effort lifting, and then their conditioning for that day may be like, you know, short 6 to 8 second all-out efforts with full recovery. So
sure,
it really depends on the day, but that's kind of the general flow of the program.
You know, so it sounds like it's kind of a undulating periodization model as far as your strength training.
Yeah, and I think our periodization model, like we like to think that it's catered towards the needs of the individuals. So when we have, you know, being in the private sector, we have a lot of younger athletes. So when like a 13-year-old kid comes in, they need something that's a little bit more consistent and a little bit more foundational and a little bit more basic so they can learn how to perform the movements properly. So, you know, if you have like back squats in one day and front squats in the other day and then lunges in another day and step-ups in another day, it's like they're going to be very mediocre at all of those exercises because they simply haven't had enough time to practice all of them. So for athletes that kind of fall in like that, this is the introduction to any sort of formal training. I think we follow a more concurrent periodization model. And then when the mid to late high school athletes have a few years of training under their belt, I think we shift into what I think of as more as a focused conjugate periodization model. And then most of our higher level guys, I think this is one of the changes we've made over the last few years, is that we're shifting into more of a block type periodization model for our college and, you know, the guys that are playing or competing for pro jobs.
Right. Now, you mentioned, you know, optimal movement, and that's obviously, you know, in watching the DVD and so much great information there, it's hard to get into it all. But you talk about, you know, kind of a four-step process to establishing optimal movement. Kind of go into that a little bit for everyone.
Sure. So I think one of the things that I've learned a lot from the Postural Restoration Institute is just the idea of joint neutrality. So, you know, I always come back to the idea that before I would overanalyze whether or not somebody has an asymmetry in their hip internal and external rotation range of motion, as an example, you want to make sure that you're starting both of those joints in the same place to measure that information from. And, you know, having gone through a lot of the PRI courses now, I can say that we're not. You know, when we look at that information, most people aren't walking in the door in a neutral position. So it becomes difficult to really accurately interpret somebody's range of motion or mobility based on that information because you don't know what's limiting them from going further. So, you know, as a kind of theoretical concept here, there are times when you would want to have limited range of motion if you're not in a neutral position, because it would be indicative of integrity of your ligament system, right?
Right.
So sometimes there's supposed to be a limitation there, and if you could say, like, well, this, you know, I don't have full hip extension on this side, and you start cranking through hip flexor stretching, you may actually just overstretch the anterior hip capsule, and you're losing integrity in a joint that we want because you're not measuring the range of motion from the appropriate starting place. And I think this is one of the big reasons why you get people that complain of clicking hips and snapping hips, doing like dead bug variations or like anything that involves hip flexion, range of motion. It's been interesting, Ron. We had a girls' high school lacrosse program in, and I think we had 24 girls that were in here training at once. And we did a like a single leg lowering exercise that, you know, it's almost like an active straight leg raise corrective from the FMS. And, you know, probably 20 of those girls were like, is my hip supposed to click? And I was like, oh, what, you know, what side was it? And they were like, oh, the left. I'm like, right, like, why? Like, even if you don't agree with what PRI is saying and, you know, you have no interest in their information, like, to me, it's like, why did all 20 have a left hip click.
Yeah.
That's interesting to me, and I think some of the PRI information starts to explain that. But to me, the foundation of measuring and optimizing joint mobility starts with giving the person the capacity to achieve a neutral starting position to begin with. And then once you have that, you have to get an idea of what is this individual's structure and what mobility do they need for what they're trying to do. You know, the mobility requirements of a gymnast are much different than like a pro hockey player or a soccer player, a football player.
Right.
You know, I think one of the big things at that level is appreciating the fact that people have different structures. And one of the things that I've done a lot of reading on over the last probably 6 years is this idea of femoroacetabular impingement. And it's really changed the way that I look at what I consider full range of motion, not just in hip motion, but in everything. And for people that aren't familiar, FAI is essentially a bony overgrowth of either the acetabular hood, which would be referred to as pincer impingement, or of the femoral head neck offset, which would be referred to as cam impingement. And, you know, there's been an explosion of research in this area. And last year in 2013, there were two pretty interesting studies that came out that have really been eye-opening, I think, for me. And one of them was looking at youth hockey players and just the incidence of this. And, you know, they looked at peewees, which is 10 to 12-year-olds, and essentially, they found that 37% of the group that they looked at had met the minimum threshold for being diagnosed with FAI. So you're talking about 10 to 12-year-olds, and over a third of them have met that threshold. And interesting, about half of them had label tears already. And then you go the next age group up, 13 to 15, and 63% of them had FAI, and 63% had label tears. And you can see where this is going, right? So 16 to 19, it was 93% of them had FAI, 93% of them had label tears. So to me, this provides pretty interesting evidence that this is a progressive adaptation to something.
Right.
I think hockey has the demand that they place on the hips is a big part of it. I think the fact that kids sit all day long is probably a bigger part of it.
Sure.
But the big thing for me is that, like, okay, by the time kids come in and they're 20 years old, we can almost assume that 100% of them are going to have some sort of limitation in hip flexion range of motion. How progressive that is, that's why we assess people. But there's going to be something. The other big thing is that almost 100% of kids are going to have label tears. So when somebody says their hip hurts, like before we ship them out to get an MRI and assume that a torn labrum is the reason why their hip hurts, you know, we might want to dig a little bit deeper and see if there's some underlying like movement mechanism or mobility restriction that may be contributing to this. And, you know, I think it's important for people to realize that my background's in hockey, so I've been looking for this information in hockey, but it's not just hockey.
And yeah, agreed.
One of the other really interesting studies that came out last year was actually in NFL prospects playing at the college level. And this one, to me, this really surprised me, honestly. And they looked at, I think it was 125 players, and they found that 90% of the players and 87% of the hips, so it's not just one hip on any given player, it's almost 90% of the hips involved in the study had findings consistent with FAI. And they found that the more progressive it was, the more likely it was that that person had symptoms. So, you know, and there's some work that I've seen that's been done on female soccer players and just found that, like, the more elite the player, and therefore the older they are, the more prevalent some of these limitations are and that sort of thing. So, you know, I would just encourage people to kind of keep their eyes open for this. It's not just hockey, and it's not just like middle-aged general population training clients. It's young, quote-unquote, like highly active athletes, and something to be aware of. So
with that being said, what's your interpretation? I mean, what are you doing differently to try to prevent that?
So if we take the stance that they're preventable,
right?
I think that the key is to limit the amount of times that people spend in end range hip flexion and to do a lot of mobility work for the posterior hip. So whether you talk about the glutes, whether you talk about the deep rotators, whether you talk about posterior capsule mobilizations, but when those things start to get dense and bound down, what happens is it actually puts a pressure to shift the femoral head further anteriorly. And you can imagine how when the acetabulum starts to tip forward on the pelvis as you descend down into a squat, that if that femoral head shifted forward earlier, you might hit end range earlier. And so those are, you know, quote unquote preventative qualities. I think coming back to the idea of helping people achieve a neutral position, maximizing mobility throughout the hips after they have that is another big one. But to me, Ryan, I think one of the biggest things is if you screen somebody out and they have this limitation, don't ignore it.
Right.
We had a Division I lacrosse player that maybe had 60 degrees of hip flexion, maybe. And I just remember kind of laughing with one of the guys that I worked with at the time. Like, can you imagine if this kid was in college and the strength coach just said, like, no, you got to squat all the way down. You got to, you know, squat ass to grass or sit on your heels or, you know, even break parallel, which is less aggressive. That's just considered a full movement. You know, and he kind of looked up and he was a great kid and he laughed and he was like, yeah, I can, because that's what I went through for several years before, you know, coming to me and me saying, like, look, like, do not do this. And if you need me to talk to your athletic coach, if you need me to talk to your college strength coach, like, whatever, but you can't, you don't have that range of motion. You see this a lot where people will hit end range hip flexion and then you see their pelvis just start to round backwards. And essentially what that is femoral head hits end range. And the only way for that bar to go lower is for the pelvis to rotate back around a fixed femur. And I can't think of a more aggressive way to tear a labrum than that. To have compression from the top down, to have the muscles around the hip joint holding on for dear life because now the pelvis is being driven posteriorly around a fixed femur, and all the pressure on the anterior labrum that occurs during that motion, and you know, not surprisingly, it's that anterior superior labrum that's the most commonly torn. So, you know, that would just be a simple modification that, you know, you see the way guys are moving, and if you think like maybe they're hitting end range hip flexion because they have excessive anterior pelvic tilt, then it's like, okay, address that. But once you've addressed that and somebody hits end range, then that may be all they have, and they're not like barring surgical intervention, they're not going to improve that through mobility work and everything else. They can maintain what they have, but you can't outstretch bone.
Right.
When it ends up being a bony limitation, there's only one way to go in, and that's surgically. So it's, I think, maybe a little bit smarter of an approach to just then coach and teach the exercise around the range of motion that that individual has available to them.
No, I agree 100%. You know, you talked about you kind of in the during an exercise, you four pervasive movement considerations that influence correct performance on almost every exercise. Well, you know, when you're coaching, what are those four influences?
Sure. So this idea kind of came out of us just having conversations with our interns, and it's like, all right, like, how do we take somebody day one and get them able to coach our athletes as quickly as possible? And you know, to me, it's like one of the big ones is neutral spine. So you know, there are movements where you would accept a non-neutral spine, like, you know, doing a med ball throw, like they're supposed to rotate through the thoracic spine. But as a general rule of thumb, when you have, when somebody's back squatting, when somebody's deadlifting, when somebody's doing a rowing exercise, like you're moving segments around a neutral spine. So that's the big one for me. And I think the one of the big parts of that I didn't get until the last few years is that the neutral spine idea doesn't just end at the thoracic spine. It continues up through the neck. So, you know, you see guys where everything's neutral and then their neck is either, you know, they've tucked their chin so hard that their neck has completely lost its curvature and they're looking down at the ground, or when their neck flies back into hyperextension.
Yep.
Both of those would constitute a loss of neutral spine in our book. Another big one is rib positioning. So, you know, just kind of looking for an anterior rib flare, and this kind of goes hand in hand with excessive lumbar hyperextension or excessive extension at that TL junction. But when you see like the ribs poking out of the front of the shirt, that would be another one. Like, we want people to stay tall, we want people to keep their chest up, but we don't want people to get a chest up by overarching through their lower back. And when people do that, you're going to see those ribs poke out. So
right.
That's another big one. Another one is just, you know, what I kind of describe as dynamic valgus control, but really it's just hip, knee, foot alignment. So this differs a little bit depending on the exercise, but as a general rule, like you want hip, knee, and toes to be in a straight line. So that straight line when you're squatting and you're out-toed, like that straight line may be angled outward slightly, but you don't want the knees to collapse in is the big one. And that, with all of these, the reason that I consider them pervasive movement considerations is because they apply across the spectrum of most exercises. So, like, I don't want somebody's knees to collapse in when they're back squatting.
Sure.
I don't want somebody to set up with their knees collapsed in when they're doing a dumbbell row or a, you know, a seated row. I don't want somebody's lower back to be hyperextended or to be overly flexed while they're squatting. Like, I don't want that while they're doing any exercise like that. So that's kind of the general idea, is that these positions, as a general rule, apply across most exercises. And I think the only one I left off was just looking at scapular setting and scapular movement. So, you know, when people are squatting or deadlifting or benching, where they have their shoulder blades kind of fixed behind them, to me, that's more of a scapular setting idea, where you want them to kind of pack their shoulder blades in the most stable position and try to maintain that throughout the movement. In contrast, you might look at rowing movements and even push-ups, where you get a little bit more of a horizontal displacement in the scapula during the movement. And then overhead movements like chin-ups and overhead pressing, where you want that scapula to kind of move up and around the outside of the ribcage as the arm goes overhead. So kind of similar idea, that those concepts apply across multiple exercises. But, you know, it takes me 15 minutes to run through those with an intern, and they kind of get it. And I just say, like, look, like, first week it's going to be a lot. Like, I just want you to keep repeating these four things and just watch the way that all of our athletes move. And you're going to start to notice that, like, you know, this kid is really good with a few of these concepts and horrible at neutral spine, you know, or they're horrible at dynamic valgus control. And then, like, now you have a blueprint to then look at every exercise through that lens and say, like, is this meeting some minimal competency level of, you know, maintaining their safety while they go through this exercise?
Oh, that's great. That's probably a huge takeaway for everybody watching right there, is being able to not only use that in the weight room, but to turn around and use that on the field and through any kind of coaching situations that you might be in, because it's applicable there as well.
Sure.
You know, you go into all this in a lot more detail in the DVD. Is there anything else you want to say specifically about the DVD and why coaches would want to purchase it?
I think, you know, I get a lot of emails about the assessment process and about, you know, quote unquote corrective exercise. And, you know, a lot of people aren't as fortunate to work with the freedom that I have at our facility, to say the least. I'm very fortunate that way. And I think you can get a lot by watching your athletes do the exercises in their program, listening to what they complain about or what they bring up as far as, you know, like,
no doubt.
Ankle clicks every single time they do a lunge. Maybe they don't have the dorsiflexion to sit into that back foot the way that they're supposed to, and that's what they're hearing. That may be why their ankle hurts. Like, switch them to an RFE split squat or a Bulgarian split squat, and it takes the stress off that back leg.
Yeah.
It's not a difficult adjustment to make. You just say, like, hey, like, you know, slide over, we're going to throw your foot on this bench. Like, try this instead.
Yeah.
Oh, and then similarly, you know, people set up at the bottom of a deadlift and, you know, they can't, like, no matter how they set up, they can't get a neutral spine at the bottom of the setup. It's like, all right, then lift the bar. You know, whether you throw it on blocks or, you know, we have two platforms that are pretty close together, so we can actually have them stand in the middle of the two platforms and just put the bar on the two platforms, so it gives them a few inches of a lift. And, you know, I think that there are small changes like that that, you know, you don't need to spend the amount of time that we do going through an assessment. You don't need to spend the amount of time that we do going through, like, teaching corrective exercise and all of those things. You can make very subtle changes to your program to make it more specific to the individual movement that every athlete has, and it won't disrupt your program.
No, I agree 100% with that. And you do it every day.
Yeah, and, you know, I think a lot of people do that and they don't think twice about it, but
exactly.
Some people, it's not that intuitive of a concept. It's like, no, like, a deadlift is deadlifting from the floor. And it's like, you know, I think that the research is now providing some evidence that would suggest that there are going to be less and less people at very young ages that have the capacity to do that than, right, you know, maybe 10, 15 years ago.
Well, you're making the adjustment there. You're making it later on when they're hurt, you know, either way.
Yeah.
You know. Well, Kev, I appreciate you coming on, man. You know, we usually end these shows with some resources. So give us a quote that you got plastered in your weight room or that you live by.
Sure. So there's a couple that I really like. I think one is by a guy named Russell Warren that he says, "Obsessed is just a word the lazy use to describe the dedicated." So I really like that. There's I think this idea that there's almost like a hesitation to encourage people to be all in, you know, to be like 100% committed and doing things all the time. It's like, no, like, you need more balance in your life. And, you know, I always come back to the idea, like, yeah, like, everybody needs some sort of balance in their life. But nothing great was ever achieved by people that were just kind of half-assing what they were going towards, you know. And I think especially with athletes, it's like, look, like, odds are you're not going to be the most talented person in any given team. You're not going to be the most athletically gifted. Like, the one thing that you have the control over is to outwork everybody in and away from the sport. So that one kind of resonates my path a little bit. But another one I got from my buddy Anthony Donskov that I think he got from his brother Misha, who coaches in the Ontario Hockey League. And it's very simply, it's just one day better. And I think that that's a motto that, since I heard Anthony say it, like, really resonates with me. It's something that I almost repeat to myself every day and say, like, right, like, I need to go to bed today knowing that I did something to make myself a little bit better. And it's something that we try to share with all of our athletes too. It's like, look, you're going to have good days and you're going to have bad days, and you're not always going to have the ability to outwork everybody, depending on, you know, if it's finals week, you didn't sleep, like, significant other broke up with you. Like, hey, sometimes life sucks, and but you still find some way to get better every day.
Oh, that's fantastic.
Just one day better. Just keep saying that to yourself and making sure that you're staying true to that.
Absolutely. Well, I see your bookshelf behind you over your shoulder there. Give us a couple book recommendations, as well as maybe an app that you use personally from, you know, outside of strength and conditioning, or one that you use for strength and conditioning, and then a website that you typically check out.
Sure. So book recommendations. I just finished a book called, I think it was Recovery for Performance in Sport. That was awesome. Really dug pretty deep into, like, the full spectrum of recovery methods and thought processes, from stretching and nutrition to compression garments to cold water immersion to, you know, some of, like, the neuromuscular electrical stimulation and all those concepts. So that was a really good one. It's expensive, but there's a book called Psychoneuroendocrinology that I saw the title and just couldn't resist. So I picked that up several months ago and dug into that one. And pretty interesting concepts. You know, I think one of the things that stuck with me is I don't even remember what the exact stat was, but it was something like they examined the hormone profile for people after they win versus after people lose, and that, you know, like, as you can imagine, it's completely different.
Sure.
So, you know, the take home from that to me was like, all right, how can we create an environment where people feel like, in our setting, that they feel like they're constantly experiencing small successes? And will that then translate into having a more favorable hormone profile to adapt to the training that we want them to adapt to?
No, so that's great. That's great right there.
That was a cool one. And then a little bit outside of the realm of strength and conditioning, but I just finished The Red Circle by Brandon Webb, which is he's the guy that was responsible for designing the sniper program for the Navy SEALs, that a lot of the now mass-publicized Navy SEAL sniper stories that have come out over the last several years, I think, right, a lot of those guys went through his program. So,
wow,
interesting to learn what those guys go through, and just their experience and the way that they approach adversity, I think, is beneficial for people to expose themselves to. And there's a good book by, I think it's Dan and Chip Heath, called Switch.
Yeah.
Just finished too, that really dives deep into behavior change. And, you know, I think that's one of the things that we're constantly looking at, is how can we get people to do the things that we want them to do without us having to constantly tell them. So,
agreed.
Trying to take some ideas and, you know, maybe re-outfit our facility with some different signs and slogans and informational banners and that sort of thing, so that, you know, they're almost passively taking in that information the entire time they're there. And
yeah,
I think you guys in the pro and college setting do that way better than we do. So you guys are probably way ahead of the curve that way, but a little slow, just trying to catch up.
Exactly why I asked the quote question, to be honest with you. It's exactly why. But what about an app that you use, maybe with your athletes or on your own? And then, you know, like you said, when you're surfing the web, where do you usually go?
You know, I really like the Zio Sleep app. And I think they went out of business or something because they don't I don't think they're around anymore. But if you can get your hands on one of those devices, which I'm sure somebody on eBay would sell it, I think right. You can still download the app. So I would look into that.
Okay.
There's one that working with a lot of high school athletes, we get a lot of kids that say, like, you know, we can't put on weight no matter what we do. And, you know, when they're all built like Gumby, it is a sign that, you know, it's like, look, like, you have all the symptoms of somebody that could be eating more, you know?
Right,
like,
absolutely.
You're not putting on weight. You're not big. You know, you're not overly strong. It's like, there's probably an obvious solution here. But, you know, when people swear over and over that they're eating as much as they possibly can, I think it helps to provide them with some hard information that suggests otherwise. And there's an app called MyFitnessPal. And I'm sure there are probably 100 of these. But
right.
The one, MyFitnessPal, allows you to enter in all your food that you put in. And, you know, I had a couple kids be like, I'm only eating 1,800 calories. And it's like, yeah, that's probably a third of what you should be eating
exactly. If
you're serious about putting on weight. So
exactly.
That's another good one. And then websites, there are tons. You know, if people aren't familiar with MikeBoyleStrengthCoach.com website, I would encourage them to check that out. If people are interested in hockey strength and conditioning, I co-run a site with Mike Potenza, Sean Skeen, and Daryl Nelson called HockeyStrengthAndConditioning.com that has some good information. Both of those are membership sites. I think if people are looking for free information, there's a lot of good stuff out there. Patrick Ward's website, OptimumSportsPerformance.com. Jeff Kubos has JeffKubos.com. Charlie Weingroff has his site. Mike Boyle has his blog. Eric Cressy, Mike Robertson, Bill Hartman, all those guys have websites that are their names.com, except Mike's, I think, might be RobertsonTrainingSystems.com. But
that's right. Yeah,
those are the ones that I spend the most time checking in and just trying to stay current with what those guys are looking into. Joel Jameson's 8weeksout.com is another one
that's a great one.
Those guys publish so much good information for free that sometimes you can almost get lost in it. You know, you can absolutely
get a
tough job out of reading all that stuff, but
no doubt.
Lots of great information, and it's out there. So,
well, your site as well is a fantastic resource, and I can't recommend that enough, and the products that you have out and some of the things that you're doing. Truly appreciate what you're doing, and appreciate you coming on the show, man.
Cool. Ron, thanks for having me. I appreciate what you're doing as well. I think you're putting in a lot of time and effort to put out these videos, and I think, you know, like we talked about before we hopped on the call, I just stumbled into how many you actually had up, and you know, I spent a couple hours today going through several, and inevitably we'll spend the next several weeks trying to dig through the rest of them. So
that's great.
For myself and everybody else that watches these, thank you.
And I appreciate it, buddy. Thanks a lot.
Cool. You got it.
One quick thing before we let you go. Want to make sure that you check out eliteform.com and ignitionapg.com and just let them know how much you appreciate them being involved with the show and helping to bring these episodes to you for free each and every week. It was awesome to have Kevin Neild on the show today. Please join me in the comments section at ronmckeefer.com thanking Kevin for coming on the show and sharing his info with us. All the show notes for this episode and the others with links that were mentioned are on the site as well. While you're there, join the mailing list so you can get updates on new shows and anything else that I have going on. If you haven't checked out strength-ondemand.com, make sure to do so as well. If you love these episodes of Iron Game Chalk Talk each week, I know you'll enjoy this. You know, it's a great product, great resource for strength and conditioning coaches to continue to learn at their own, on their own time from their own homes. Lastly, please subscribe to us on iTunes and YouTube, as well as leave a positive rating and review so that we can continue to bring this show to as many strength coaches as possible. That's it for this week. Be sure to check back next week for another great episode of Iron Game Chalk Talk. Take care.